This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
Today on the program, at more than 43 million, the number of refugees is higher than in the past decade.
We are seeing a multiplication of new crises since the beginning of the year. Cote d'Ivoire, Libya, Syria, Yemen. And at the same time, it seems that old crises never end.
Why there are not enough funds to protect children in precarious situations.
We literally try to get children out of the line of fire, you know, and get children away from situations of trafficking and, you know, exposure to extreme violence, which is most certainly life-threatening.
And triggering South Asia's potential for development.
There has been prolonged history of conflict among states in South Asia. There is a great degree of mistrust among countries, and therefore much of the areas in which trust building needs to be worked out has not progressed much well in South Asia.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspa in Bonn. Hundreds of thousands of people in East Africa are currently leaving their homes to flee the ongoing drought in the region. Many have reached camps in Kenya in the past few weeks. All over the world, there are currently more than 43 million refugees. Most of them have fled to escape civil war, violence and unrest. While two out of three refugees are displaced within their own home countries, millions of others are forced to live in exile. In 1951, the UN's Refugee Convention defined the rights of refugees abroad for the first time. But it does not protect those who are internally displaced. Helle Jeppesen looks at the situation of refugees today. Her report is presented by Susan Holton.
The number of refugees in the world, 43 million, is now higher than at any time over the last decade. Most of these people have been driven from their homes by violence, civil wars and ethnic conflicts. Millions of people have fled war-torn countries like Afghanistan, Iraq and Somalia. Others are forced to leave home because of natural disasters, like the current drought in East Africa. Antonio Guterres is the UN High Commissioner for Refugees.
We are seeing a multiplication of new crises. Since the beginning of the year, Cote d'Ivoire, Libya, Syria, Yemen. And at the same time, it seems that old crises never end. Look at what's happening in Afghanistan, more than 20 years of fighting, in Somalia, again 20 years of fighting, in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Guterres presented the UN's 2010 report on refugees in Rome last month. Presenting the report in Italy was a conscious choice. Italy has been one of the main destinations for refugees from North Africa in recent months. Italian politicians have often talked about a flood or even a tsunami of refugees reaching Italian shores. But in reality, only about 18,000 have reached the Italian island of Lampedusa since the beginning of the conflict. But even if refugees survive the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean on overcrowded vessels, reaching European shores does not guarantee them asylum in Europe. Upon arrival, refugees first have a status as asylum seekers. They have to undergo a lengthy legal process to be granted or refused political asylum in a given country. The decision can take years. If they are granted asylum, refugees enjoy the protection of their host country. They receive an ID and are free to travel. Different European countries have different asylum laws, which has raised criticism. German President Christian Wulff has called for a uniform asylum policy for Europe.
Für ein Europa, das in Frieden,
for Europe, which emphasizes peace, respect for the rule of law and democracy, it should go without saying that we show solidarity towards those who need protection.
Die schutzbedürftig sind.
Since February, more than 1 million refugees from Libya fled to neighboring Egypt and Tunisia, whereas Europe has only accepted a fraction of that amount. Four out of five refugees today are living in developing countries, the UN's Antonio Guterres says.
So it's simply not true that refugees are moving massively to the north. The truth is that if there is a burden, and I don't like to use the word burden, but if there is an exercise of responsibility in refugee protection, that exercise of responsibility is essentially assumed by the countries of the South, by the countries of the developing world.
Usually it's neighbouring countries which host refugees, like Kenya, which has opened its borders to hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing drought in Somalia and Ethiopia. Millions of others are facing a famine on the Horn of Africa. Another example is Liberia, which now hosts more than 180,000 Ivorian refugees, despite still bearing scars from its own civil war. Many Ivorian refugees are staying in private homes, according to Ibrahim Akoli from the UN's refugee organization in Liberia.
Having been received for years when they were in Cote d'Ivoire as refugees, many Liberians today consider that it is their duty to reciprocate. There are also very strong ethnic affinities which tie those populations on both sides of the border.
Three out of four refugees first flee to neighbouring countries, where they often stay for years, hoping to be able to eventually go back home. But more often than not, refugees can't return. In 2010, the number of refugees who did return home was smaller than in the previous two decades. In most cases, the conflicts they had fled were ongoing. However, two-thirds of refugees are displaced within their own countries. They have not crossed an international border. These are the so-called internally displaced people, or IDPs. There are some 27.5 million of them, and they make up more than two-thirds of all refugees. Their numbers have climbed over the past decade. Only about 10% of them were able to return to their homes last year, most of them in Pakistan or the Democratic Republic of Congo. Legally, internally displaced people do not fall under the Geneva Convention, which protects refugees in exile. The convention, which was ratified in 1951, says that refugees cannot be deported to countries where they fear persecution. It also guarantees refugees the right to medical care, education, and work in their host countries. But what happens if refugees cannot return home? That's what the UNHCR is currently trying to solve. The UN says that if people cannot return home after more than 5 years, they need to be given the chance to resettle elsewhere. UN High Commissioner Guterres says many countries, especially rich ones, ought to change their attitudes towards refugees.
And I would say that it is particularly worrying what today is happening in several areas of the developed world. Because of more restrictive attitudes in relation to migration, because of security concerns, especially after 9/11, the truth is that borders are more and more closed, and the truth is that the access of people to asylum in the developed world, in many parts of that developed world, is becoming more difficult. Even physical access to the territory is sometimes denied.
Susan Holten, Deutsche Welle Radio.
In situations of crises, it's often children who are most affected. A recent study by a coalition of some 20 international aid agencies has found that protection programs for children caught in conflict and natural disasters are, after education, the most underfunded operations. A lack of protection programs has devastating consequences for refugee and displaced children who become vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. Many become victims, for example, of trafficking, of sexual exploitation or child labour. Governments tend to give money to high-profile, visible projects, such as food emergencies and efforts to get cholera and other diseases under control. They like to show how their money works. But protection programs for children don't grab the limelight, they operate in the shadows, so they don't attract much money. Lisa Schlein reports.
Last year, 250 million people were affected by natural disasters. Half of the victims were children. According to the following UN video, conflict also claims hundreds of thousands of victims every year, and it's children who are the poorest and most vulnerable in society who suffer the most.
During crisis, the people and structures that may have protected children, families, homes, schools, communities, government services, religious institutions are often decimated.
And yet, during these times of crisis, when children most need help from the international community, they're not getting it. Rashid Khalikov is director of the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Geneva. He says the international community pays a lot of lip service to the importance of protecting children. But when it comes to financially supporting such activities, it falls short of the mark. Over the last 4 years, he says that UN appeals for child protection activities have received only 40% of their funding needs. In some areas, that number is even lower.
Child protection issues very often are parts of larger protection issues when it comes to emergencies like ones in Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, and Sudan. And one could see that in Democratic Republic of Congo, that is 22%, Somalia 9%, and Sudan 12% of funding. I would like to tell you that Libya, child protection activities are not funded at all. Not a single penny came to the funding of that area, and that is a very important area.
Dermot Carty, deputy director of the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, calls this disconcerting but not surprising. He says child protection activities in emergencies are underfunded because they're not as visible as operations that provide clean water and sanitation or those that tackle cholera or other disease outbreaks. He says governments like to see what they're getting for their money, but showing how children are being protected from abuse and exploitation is very difficult to do. Unfortunately, he says money governments give to the United Nations tends to be earmarked for specific programs and can only be spent in those areas.
I think the notion that there is a pile of money that goes into the UN and that the UN establishment has the ability to be able to put the hand in the pot and pull out that money and use it for its priorities. Unfortunately, life is not quite as simple as that. We do not have the ability to be able to do that.
And when that happens, children get into trouble. For example, Carty says one of the best ways of protecting children is to create so-called friendly spaces. These places offer counseling for traumatized children and access to basic services such as health care and nutrition. They provide a space where children can play games, where they can be safe. Without these services, Carty says, children wander aimlessly around displaced persons camps. This makes them vulnerable to abuse and trafficking. They often fall prey to people who want to sell them or sexually exploit them or put them into slavery and other forms of abuse. He cites the chaotic situation that followed last year's devastating earthquake in Haiti. He says normal rules that previously had applied no longer existed. As a result, many children fell prey to people traffickers.
We don't have to go back too far to see the situation as was happening in Haiti because there wasn't a protective policy environment in Haiti. So it was easier, if you like, than it should have been for children to be removed from the country. There weren't sufficient support services to provide basic services.
In 2009, the United States was the largest single donor to child protection programs. It provided $13 million, or nearly one-third of overall funding. The Common Humanitarian Fund, comprising a number of donors and UN organizations, was the second biggest donor, providing nearly $4.5 million, or less than 10% of overall funding needs. Coordinator of the Child Protection Working Group, Katie Barnett, says protection activities attract little money because donors are under the misconception that these are not life-saving programs.
I think it's extraordinary, given that we literally, in some cases, are trying to get children out of the line of fire, and get children away from situations of trafficking and exposure to extreme violence, which is most certainly life-threatening.
Karen Gulick is the UN Refugee Agency's Chief of Protection Operations. She says child protection might gain more support if donors understood these programs don't operate in a vacuum. They are integrated with overall refugee programs, and what affects adults often impacts children too. She cites the example of an operation in one country which had child-friendly spaces that offered a safe environment. Despite this, she says this operation failed to protect children because a program intended for adults did not work out as planned, inadvertently ensnaring children in a bad situation.
But there was a horrible issue with access to livelihoods, and people were not able to work. The effect being that if adults went out to work, they would be arrested and detained without judicial review. The children would not be arrested. And so the impact was that we saw a huge increase in child dropout and child labor and exploitation.
Gulick says when donors were asked for money to fund small home-based livelihood projects, no one saw this as being potentially bad for children. It was not seen as a protection issue because children were at home with their working parents. Aid agencies are forced to scale back their operations when money for child protection is not available or limited. In many cases, they have to eliminate them entirely. When there is limited money, the funds go for basic survival needs, for food, for water, and health care. What gets lost in the mix are important programs, including counseling for severely traumatized children or the construction of safe environments where children can go to school and play and be protected from predators who wish them harm. Lisa Schlein, Deutsche Welle Radio, Geneva.
Still to come here on World in Progress, a report about the potential for South Asian development. But first, Hannah Wandel takes a quick glance at some development news.
More aid needed to help drought victims. Aid organisations are calling for more donations, saying not enough is being done to help people in East Africa. Somalia is the worst affected country in the Horn of Africa by a prolonged drought that has put some 12 million people across the region in danger of starvation and spurred a global fundraising campaign. Nearly half of Somalia's estimated 10 million people are in need of relief assistance, owing to the effects of relentless violence and the drought that has prompted the UN to declare a famine for the first time this century. Hundreds of thousands have already left their homes in Somalia and Ethiopia, fleeing to neighbouring Kenya, where refugee camps are already overcrowded. At an emergency meeting in Rome earlier this week, officials said the UN had received almost €700 million since first launching an appeal for the region in November 2010, but needs half a billion more by the end of the year to cope with the emergency. More deaths, arrests as Syria presses crackdown. Security forces in Syria have arrested so many people that the country has become a huge prison, activists said on Tuesday, as the crackdown on dissent shows no sign of easing. The National Organization for Human Rights listed the names of 250 people who have been arrested nationwide in past weeks. Rights groups say at least 12,000 people have been detained since the anti-regime protests erupted, but many have not been identified. At least 1,486 civilians have been reported killed since mid-March, among them women and children. Syrian activists said protesters will intensify demonstrations demanding the end of President Assad's rule during the month of Ramadan, which starts on the 1st of August. Land grabs in Africa threaten food security. Rich countries grabbing farmland in Africa to feed their growing populations can make the continent's hunger problems more severe, according to a study published by Washington-based think tank the World Watch Institute. The group conducted hundreds of interviews with farmers' groups, scientists and officials in 25 African countries. They found that rural populations can be left without land or jobs when land purchase is not properly monitored and goes undocumented. It is estimated that some 15 million to 20 million hectares of land in sub-Saharan Africa have been purchased by foreign investors in the past 5 years, mostly by wealthier nations from the Middle East and Asia, particularly China. Africa cannot feed itself if the Chinese and Saudis are taking up the best land for production for food, Danielle Nierenberg, director of World Watch's Nourishing the Planet project, told Reuters. The group encouraged more international monitoring in cash for land deals. Sudan jails second journalist for reporting rape. On Monday, Sudan jailed a journalist for reporting the alleged rape of a female opposition activist by security forces, her lawyer said, in a trial that has already seen another reporter imprisoned. The court in Khartoum sentenced Amal Habani to pay 2,000 Sudanese pounds, about 600 euros, or go to jail for 1 month, and she chose to go to jail, Hassan Abdullah Al-Hussein told news agency AFP. Earlier this month, Fatima Ghazali became the first of several journalists and editors to be tried for articles written about Savaya Ashak, an activist who claimed that she was raped repeatedly by three security officers. Reporters Without Borders has accused the authorities in North Sudan of harassing and prosecuting journalists in an attempt to stop them from making embarrassing revelations about human rights violations by the security forces. Freedom of expression can be limited only in exceptional circumstances. The United Nations Human Rights Committee, in a document, confirmed the central role of freedom of expression in human rights, making it clear that it can only be limited in the most exceptional circumstances. It also called for unrestricted public access to official information, giving people access to more than just one source of information. No state can tell people what to think, one official said. The committee also said that limits on freedom of expression can only be applied in very exceptional situations, like incitement to hatred and discrimination on religious or racial ground, but that does not apply to blasphemy. Final approval of the text is expected to come at the next meeting in October. Activists slam Myanmar's environmental practices. The Myanmar regime is undertaking widespread, large-scale industrial projects without regard for environmental and social consequences, an activist group said on Monday. The regime, which derives most of its revenues from the extraction industry and hydroelectricity, has failed to implement any of the UN guidelines it signed up to, the Burma Environment Working Group said in a statement. The environmentalists criticised the 48 hydroelectric dams at various stages of construction along the Irrawaddy River and its tributaries. A large part of the electricity is to be sold to neighbouring countries.
That was Hannah Wandel with the development news. South Asia is one of the strategically most important regions in the world. The issues facing it range from stabilising Afghanistan, overcoming Indian and Pakistan animosities, to fostering underdeveloped regional cooperation as a prerequisite for more prosperity. This last objective is anything but new. Back in 1985, Bangladesh, Bhutan, India, the Maldives, Nepal, Pakistan and Sri Lanka founded the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, or SAARC, which was joined by Afghanistan in 2007. But as an international conference at the Adenauer Foundation in Berlin recently showed, progress in the area has been slow. Hadi Graupner has more for this edition of World in Progress.
South Asia is home to roughly 1.5 billion people, amounting to over 23% of the global population. The region spanning the SAARC nations is still pretty much classified as a low-income area, where fighting poverty and hunger remain among the major challenges in the years ahead. But as Munir Munirozaman from the Bangladesh Institute for Peace and Security Studies pointed out in Berlin, present-day attempts to ease the hardships are still being hampered by geopolitical strains.
The reason is the region's history has been marred in animosity and conflict. There has been prolonged history of conflict among states in South Asia, and even the current generation is carrying a lot of the history baggage of the predecessors when there have been violent conflicts in the region. We are also extremely worried, as smaller countries in the region, that it is perhaps the most nuclearized part of the world. There is a great degree of mistrust and misbelief among countries, and therefore much of the areas in which trust and trust building needs to be worked out has not progressed much well in South Asia.
The eight countries belonging to SAARC couldn't be any more different in terms of democratic developments, says Nishal Pandey from the Center for South Asian Studies in Kathmandu, Nepal. His own country's democracy has been deadlocked for years, even after the end of the civil war in 2006. While India boasts to have the biggest democracy in the world, there are many challenges to the system. And also in other countries in the region, genuine democratic systems that actually work are still few and far between.
Political parties in our region remain under the control of a few dynastic rulers. Very little has been done towards the realization of social and economic goals. And a large number of the impoverished still living in squatter conditions, which various armed groups, gangs and outfits exploit for political gains. South Asia is also home to 1/5 of the total world population. yet it is the poorest region after sub-Saharan Africa.
Breaking up purely nationalist attitudes is therefore key to Dipankar Banerjee from the Institute for Peace and Conflict Studies in New Delhi, India.
Politics is national, in South Asia especially, as it has emerged from colonial rule, and our nationalisms are comparatively young. And if you want to think about the future and prosperity of South Asia, there is no alternative but regional cooperation to bring that about.
In fact, some of the nations in the area are only about half a century old. Partitioning after colonial rule brought about conflicts that didn't exist before. Take the simmering conflict between India and Pakistan over Kashmir. Salma Malik from Qaid-e-Azam University in Islamabad, Pakistan, maintains that South Asia doesn't have to look very far to profit from the experience of other blocs that have aspired to boost regional cooperation.
There's also not a want of models to emulate. We have the ASEAN right next door. We also have the European Union. There are so many things that SAARC has or the South Asian countries have to learn from the rest of the world and use the best practices, so to speak.
But Malik refers to SAARC's charter that does not include any focus on resolving political spats, neither internally nor across borders. And she points to the European Union, which hasn't been able to defeat internal violence in Northern Ireland or Spain either. Nonetheless, a regional approach to economic issues can help to avoid additional tension, argues Munia Muniruzzaman.
I would also like to cite the example of the energy security issue that has come out between India and Bhutan, for example. In that case, the price of the electricity that the Bhutanese are exporting to India is far, far below the market price. And when we talk to our Indian counterparts as to why is this pricing in this manner, the reply that we got is this is a friendship price. So friendship, when it is imposed by a larger country, is not a practical friendship, and that cannot be sustained for regional cooperation and for regional energy security grids. Therefore, I firmly believe that we have to approach the issues on a regional basis.
There's no doubt that interstate cooperation in South Asia would be given a terrific boost if borders were opened up, but at present, policymakers in the area don't even think of doing that. Dipankar Banerjee again.
People-to-people contact in South Asia has been limited, and we need to open up. We want to have people to move across borders. We want to ensure that the unlawful, illegal criminals don't have access to that. We have not been able to do that. It comes back to the same questions of terrorism. We cannot open up our borders because of the fear.
Former long-standing German Conservative MP Klaus-Jürgen Heydrich says his country is called upon to invest more in the stability of South Asia by aiding cross-border economic trade. Emphasizing that his view has no majority in his own Christian Democratic Party, he adds that what Germany should not have done is to send troops to Afghanistan.
In my eyes, it's ridiculous that the West sends troops to the region to solve problems, whereas at the same moment all the neighbors stay out. If I take into consideration that our military commitment is disliked by the people, I always should recommend we should pull out tonight. Not tomorrow.
A small number of South Asian economists maintains that the area doesn't have to look for outside help at all, neither in the military nor in the economic field. The European model, they say, is too much focused on individual freedoms and advances, while in Asia, the family-based traditions still play an overarching role. The truth may lie somewhere in between, but one thing seems certain. The key to more prosperity, first and foremost, lies in the South Asian nations themselves, in building an atmosphere of trust and mutual understanding. Hardy Graupner, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
And this report wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. If you want to find out more about development issues or you'd like to listen to our reports again, check out our webpage at dw-world.de/development. We'll be back next week when one of our topics will be how society is treating disabled people. So please do tune in again next week at the same time. Until then, on behalf of the studio team here in Bonn, Iliane Giaducci and Marco Dittmar, I'm Anke Rasper saying thanks for listening and goodbye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.